Welcome to the Logic Consortium. Today on the show, we're going to be speaking with economist and law professor Andrew Morris. He's going to be talking a little bit about his article, The Seven Myths About Green Jobs. And we're going to be talking a little bit more about the role of government in general and markets and just some of the general debates across there. So thanks so much to Professor Morris for joining us, and please stick around. Thank you very much.
Well, as you talk about in your paper, there's a real aggressive push for greening the economy, which proponents say can produce a remarkable range of benefits, from improving environmental quality to innovation to increased income. And you really you point out that it really isn't this simple as some make it out to be, and that some of the underlying assumptions in this literature need to be given a second look. And that maybe even they may even be a result of special interests advocating for money to be thrown their way, and that we should especially be careful because people are thinking about spending hundreds of billions of dollars on these types of programs. So could you kind of give us the broad strokes of why it isn't as easy as some say?
Well, there's a couple key points to think about. The first is that these projections and assumptions that are getting made are usually made on the basis of very limited data and are often projections out of very high growth rates as something goes from 0.25% to 1%. And those are growth rates that are not sustainable larger. So there's some questionable statistical techniques being used. In particular, there's a modeling technique called input-output analysis that gets used for a lot of this to calculate the number of jobs that are going to come about. And input-output analysis assumes constant technology and constant prices. And most of the green jobs claims are, of course, based on changes in technology and changes in prices. So it's an inappropriate technique, modeling issues to be dealt with. The second set of points is that there's a real bias in the assumptions about technology that are in these analyses. So technologies that the authors of these studies like tend to be assumed to have really dramatic improvements in costs coming in the future, whereas technologies that they don't like are assumed to not have improvements in costs. But actually, the disfavored technologies are ones that we have seen remarkable improvements in costs over the last 50 to 100 years, and there's no reason to think those are going to change. And then there's a third set of problems with the these studies, which are that they tend not to properly account for labor costs. So instead of treating labor costs as a cost, they treat them as a benefit. So they're counting the number of people employed rather than looking at the productivity of labor.
Which is definitely, that third point is something I really want to come back to. But what about the seemingly simple solution of, you know, creating tax incentives for those engaged in wind and solar production?
Well, why is it that we think that we should spend tax money on a particular technology rather than using incentives to encourage people to accomplish results? Right, so picking technological winners is not something the government has ever done well, and is not doing particularly well now.
Okay. Well, one thing that you know, the third point that you kind of brought up and that you mentioned in the paper is that some of the literature advocates for a less efficient use of labor that might be more environmentally friendly. For example, I think you mentioned picking fruit off trees instead of mechanization. But you mentioned that increasing labor productivity should be our goal. Less inputs to produce the same outputs, and that this produces a better standard of living for everyone. But there are many that argue that increased mechanization, and for that matter, outsourcing of jobs, leaves people without a job worse off especially because many times those who lose the jobs may not have the skills to compete for the new jobs that might pop up. Can you comment on this a little bit?
Well, I think it's simply false to say that people are better off with fewer alternatives. So if you give people more alternatives, they're better off. Second, everybody's both a producer and a consumer. And in our roles as consumers, we're made better off by reduced prices, which happen when costs get lower. So the objection to the green jobs literature has really got two parts in your question. The first objection is that it treats labor costs as a benefit, not as a cost. And the second is that it thinks that maximizing employment is the goal, right? And so it was opposed to trade and opposed to things that tend to lower costs. So if we look at the first objection first. If we're looking at labor productivity, what we want are high labor productivity jobs, because those are jobs where labor's reward will be greater. So those are high-paying jobs. The only way you're going to get high-paying jobs assembling wind turbines is through a subsidy. And subsidies generally aren't sustainable because they got to come out of somebody else's pocket, and they're not, so people are going to object to paying them, and they're inefficient. So we have, on the one hand, we can have lots of low-quality, low-labor productivity jobs with poor pay. On the other hand, we can promote increased labor productivity, which is going to lead to higher pay and better jobs. So that seems that the appropriate type of things we want to encourage are high labor productivity jobs, that leads to high wages. As far as treating labor costs as a benefit, if you give me $1 million, I can hire a lot of people and they produce nothing. But at the end, $1 million is gone. There's nothing. There's no value been added. We need jobs that add value, that create wealth, not jobs that simply dissipate wealth.
Kind of along these lines a little bit, and strain from the article just for a second. Do you think that people might be more inclined to support markets, trade, and outsourcing and mechanization if there was a more solid baseline of healthcare, education, and other public goods being provided in society by some type of redistribution system?
No. I mean, I think that you're sort of saying that would people be inclined to accept markets in one sphere of their life if they didn't have them in the other sphere of their life? And the gains, so if you want to protect part of your life in exchange, you'll accept markets in the other part. The point about markets is they make everybody better off when we do them all around, not when we do them in a limited area. And so to get the benefit, I can't protect the things I want to protect and just have markets and things that I don't want to protect, while you protect the things you want to protect and the markets and the things that you don't want to protect. We need to all get together. There's gains all around for us. And so I don't think the problem is that there's insufficient protection. I think the problem is there's too many distortions in things like healthcare. So if we actually had a market for healthcare, I think people would probably be a lot happier. John Mackey, for example, the CEO of Whole Foods, put out a very good market-based plan for improving healthcare in this country and getting a lot of the distortions introduced by the tax system and by government regulations out of it, and showed how he's doing that at Whole Foods.
One thing that you talk about in the paper is that there are some that say that corporations are too short-sighted to make investments that might produce profits in the long term. And you really hear that argument a lot, that their fiduciary duty is to create profits for their stockholders, which really prevents them from looking towards the long term. You do hear that argument. So, but you talk about that you think that this is a pretty dubious argument. And could you talk about this a little bit?
Right. Well, there's two parts to two kinds of responses. One is compared to what, right? So you're saying corporations are short-sighted compared to what? So what we do know is that governments are extremely short-sighted and that the time horizon for an elected official is from now until the next election. So the House of Representatives is mostly concerned about what's going to happen in 2010. They're not looking at a long-term perspective. If they're not reelected in 2010, they're out of a job. And so anything that they do, they want to have the benefits happen before 2010, and they like to put the cost past 2010 if they can, so that potentially they don't have to deal with them. The same thing with the executive branch. Every president is always looking to the next election. So governments aren't particularly gifted with any kind of ability to see into the future more than anybody else. But what corporations have is that they're using their own resources. They're not using somebody else's resources. So if a government makes a big bet on a technology and it doesn't work out, as we did in the 70s with a Synfuels Corporation, intends to create a synthetic fuel, well, you know, it's not their money. If a company makes a big bet on a bad technology, it goes out of business. And those resources get redistributed to people who have better ideas. So the market provides, I think, a better mechanism for thinking about the future than does the political system. And the second is that it is true that corporations focus on the bottom line, but the bottom line incorporates, their stock price incorporates the long-run opportunities for their company. And so people discount the price of a stock if they think the company doesn't have a long-run strategy and they don't have a plan for making profits in the future. So they do have to take a longer view. Now, there are problems that come up with, you know, sort of meeting next quarter's earnings targets and so forth like that, but those are mostly addressed on the margin. Those are not fundamental problems with the stock market. They're problems with particular incentive schemes.
But isn't the government the one that does the long-term investment in basic low-level research that produces all sorts of innovations later on down the line that you know, corporations might not be willing to invest?
Right, the SAFE program gave us Tang. Right, that's the example that comes up all the time. I mean, there really aren't particularly good examples of the government producing useful products out of basic research. But if you're talking about National Science Foundation studies and things like that, that's a relatively harmless thing to engage in as long as there's a reasonable process for allocating the money. That's not what the Green Jobs people are talking about. They're talking about giving money to companies right now to change the products they're producing today, not talking about funding basic research. So the big push into green jobs is not a push into basic research. It's a push into technologies that aren't making it in the marketplace to subsidize them in an effort to get them to make it in the marketplace. And subsidizing losing technologies is a great way for special interests to raid the public treasury. General Electric, for example, is a big fan of compact fluorescent light bulbs, which is something that they have a lot of patents on and are a big producer of, but which are noticeably inferior to some other lighting technologies.
And so they're in their lobbying, you're saying, for tax dollars to be spent on those.
Right, or for mandates for people to have to use their product. That's where we get the you know, the front-loading washing machine from.
Can you explain that for a sec? Hello?
Yeah, still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
You cut out for a minute.
Yeah. What's the front-loading washing machine effect? Can you talk about that?
Well, front-loading washing machines were developed, but Americans have a preference for top-loading washing machines because they're cheaper. So the companies that had spent a lot of money developing front-loading washing machines persuaded the Department of Energy and EPA to put in energy efficiency standards that require all washing machines sold after a date, which I think is in 2010 or 2011, to be front loaders, to create a market for this stuff that they spent a lot of money developing.
So you're just saying it's basically political rent seeking.
Exactly.
Okay, one thing that you mentioned in the paper is that over time markets have promoted more conservation and more efficient uses of energy. And you mentioned how important information is to this. on what is the most efficient or environmentally friendly energy usage. Do you think that what do you think is the best way to disseminate the information? And do you think the government might have a role in helping to disseminate some of this information more widely, or that just runs contrary to what you were just mentioning?
Well, there's two kinds of information dissemination. One is learn about resource use and competing uses for resources, and that's what the price system does. So if demand for some natural resource goes up somewhere, the price of it goes up, and I don't really need to know why demand went up somewhere else. All I need to know is the price went up, and I'll conserve on my use of it. The second is disseminating information, say, for example, about the energy efficiency of appliances, and there are labeling rules and things like that that can help standard setting. So, for example, most major appliances now have a sticker on them that shows their annual energy use and how that falls within the range of competing appliances. So you have a sense when you're buying a washing machine or a refrigerator how much energy it's going to take to operate that over the year and how one compares to another. Those are useful things that can be encouraged both through private standard setting organizations, but also the government can play a role in that. But in terms of disseminating information about how rare a commodity is or something like that, that's something that you really have to do through the price system.
Can you, you talked, jumping back to something that you mentioned before, healthcare and Mackey's suggestion, you're talking about a lot of the healthcare distortions that are out there. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Well, I can give you a couple, but I mean, I think you better get David Hyman on if you want to talk about distortions in the healthcare market. But one, for example, we subsidize the provision of healthcare through employers, which makes very little sense since people change jobs frequently during their lives. But by giving a tax deduction to employers but not to employees when they buy insurance, we make it cheaper for insurance to be provided by the employer. And that's why our healthcare system is so based around employment-based healthcare. But that also introduces a distortion that I'm not paying for my healthcare, my employer is, so I get no price signals on the consequences of my choices and my behavior.
I guess kind of wrapping up here, there's such a crippling left-right debate in this country right now that is manifesting itself in all sorts of arguments. Can you give us your view on this this debate and how we can overcome?
Well, there's always been a vigorous argument in this country about the role of government. That's been true since the founding. So if you go back and read some of the things that were said about people during debates in the 19th century and the early 20th century, they are just as crude and obnoxious and vitriolic and unsophisticated as things that get said today. I don't think that things are worse today than they were, say, back when people were accusing Grover Cleveland of having an illegitimate child or Andrew Jackson of being a murderer, things like that. So, you know, we have a tradition of this kind of debate, we've survived it for over 200 years, and I don't see any reason we're not going to continue to survive it. That said, people could certainly be more civil to each other, but when they aren't, hopefully everybody can go out for a beer afterwards and get over it.
So you're basically, that's a pretty pessimistic picture that you're painting, that there will kind of always be this debate that will manifest itself into petty little accusations and arguments.
That is an optimistic view. We've survived it and thrived despite it, we don't need to get so hung up about it.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. Anything else you want to say? Or?
Well, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise. And,
And that was Professor Andrew Morris of the University of Illinois College of Law and Professor of Law, Professor of Business, talking about a whole slew of things. So thanks so much to Professor Morris for joining us and getting after it here on the Logic Consortium. And thanks so much to all those listening, and to Scientific Map and Matt Hudson for Fear for Disappear, this song. Thank you so much. Take care.